LaFond, is that right? And Mr. Kozlowski, excellent. So our third case for this morning is Hinterberger versus the City of Indianapolis, number 19-3365, and we can proceed. Oh, by the way, I will let you know when I need to know how much time you've reserved for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Wood. The appellants have reserved 2 minutes.
Okay, thanks. So you may proceed.
Thank you. And may it please the court, my name is Michael Kozlowski, and I represent the plaintiffs' appellants, Mr. Leif Hinterberger, and the related entities in this matter. We're here today asking that you reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment to the city and remand so that this case can be heard on its merits. Mr. Hinterberger's claims have never been heard on their merits. At the district court level, this case was resolved on summary judgment based solely on the city's version of the facts. The district court struck Mr. Hinterberger's version of the facts. In opposing summary judgment, Mr. Hinterberger submitted 135 exhibits and a statement of facts that was 20 pages long, divided into 9 sections, all of which was disregarded. Instead, the district court relied solely on the city's submitted statement of facts, which consisted entirely of 30 numbered paragraphs and cited to only 22 exhibits.
So, but Mr. Kozlowski, reading the district court's opinion, the district court was, as you I'm sure well know, quite distressed, I'll say, exasperated with Mr. Hinterberger's statement. The references didn't match up to what they were purporting to be. There wasn't focus. I mean, there were a lot of things, which is why she struck that. Now, you still take the city's facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Hinterberger, but why did she abuse her discretion in evaluating that submission as she did?
The district court abused its discretion in striking Mr. Hinterberger's statement of facts because the district court ignored actual evidence that was submitted to it on judgment. Now,
I think she thought that whatever that actual evidence was too hard to find, basically. I mean, she checks out a lot of things and gives quite a few examples of things that seem to be significant deficiencies.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The district court identified a number of deficiencies, like errors to citations or a particular exhibit appearing multiple times, or an argumentative statement of facts. The district court's opinion refers to especially syntax and an overly argumentative statement of facts or used to justify its striking of the statement of facts. However, the court abused its discretion in doing so because all of the reasons that the district court gave for disregarding Mr. Hinterberger's facts were solely within the ken, as I say, of Mr. Hinterberger's lawyers. Now, we know that a client is bound by his lawyer's conduct, and that the party is made to suffer litigation consequences as a result of both good lawyering and bad lawyering. But here we have a unique scenario where the district court entered a rule to show cause against those responsible for the reasons behind the striking of the statement of facts.
And Mr. Kozlowski, it's Judge Scudder. To pick up on what Judge Wood is asking you, do you have any issue, or do you join issue with any of the particularity of Judge Barker's findings? For example, as Judge Wood mentioned, Judge Barker takes care to go through at least 2, maybe 3 different examples, and she traces out what's cited. Is any of that, in your view, wrong? Does she make a mistake in that?
We do not argue with the factual examples given by the district court. The district court is correct when the district court says, for example, that a particular citation does not necessarily support as broad a fact as the sentence that preceded it in the briefing below. However, we do dispute the consequence of that. Based on the district court's order,
I understand that. Yeah, that's, I understand that point. That's a slightly different argument, right? That way. Okay. All right. Cause I'll tell you, I looked at, I picked two other places just almost randomly in the summary judgment briefing. And I tried to see if I could trace different things out on points that were important. And in both instances, I ran into trouble. And so my observation is no more from doing that, that Judge Barker's distress and exasperation seems well placed.
I agree. I agree, Your Honor. I also spent quite a bit of time sussing out the facts. And I think that the district court's exasperation, consternation even, is well placed with those responsible for the incorrect citation and for those responsible for the argumentative nature of the facts. And what we have here is a special situation where the party has been sanctioned, as the judge entered a litigation sanction, as the district court called it, and a rule to show cause against Mr. Hinneberger's trial counsel. But the result that we end up with is diametrically opposed, where the party is made to suffer the litigation sanction for conduct that is clearly lawyers' work, whereas the lawyers were not made to suffer any type of sanction under Rule 11 or otherwise for the exact same wrongdoing. And that inconsistency is what demonstrates that the district court's opinion here and the result is an unreasonable one.
My follow-up question is this.
Go ahead, Judge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just one real brief question. And that is, let's assume, and I know you don't want us to decide it this way, that you're perfectly clear on that. I get it. But let's assume that we strike the plaintiff's version of facts and accept the defense version of facts in their entirety, wholesale. Can you prevail on the merits of any claim if we do that? And if so, maybe the better way to ask the question is, what's your best claim if we were to do that? You know, I know contrary to your wishes.
I can answer that in two parts. First, whether Mr. Hinneberger could prevail on any claim, if his statement of facts were stricken and the defendants were adopted wholesale, the answer is no. The city statement of facts is so narrow and focuses solely on an entitlement to public funds and does not go through the litany of facts that are set out in the appellant's statement of the case here, showing a pattern of disparate treatment. Without that pattern of disparate treatment over a period of years, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for Mr. Hinneberger to prevail on any of the claims asserted. That being said, the strongest claim, if a reasonable inference should be drawn in Mr. Hinneberger's favor based on the city's facts, the strongest claim would be the IUTSA claim, the trade secrets claim, given that the facts submitted by the defendant show that there clearly was a real estate development transaction happening here, or a series of transactions happening, and that these types of economic analyses and modeling were exchanged. But even that claim, strong as it may be compared to the others, is substantially weaker the plaintiff's facts are completely ignored here, as they were on the district court level. And that gets to a broader point, which is Mr. Hinneberger's claims are in fact much broader than the city has suggested they are, and that the district court has also suggested that they are. Mr. Hinneberger's claims are not about a particular real estate developer being entitled to public money. This is not Mr. Hinderberger making a federal case out of being entitled to taxpayer dollars. The case is much broader and is about calling a local government to account for its mistreatment. And it's disparate.
But here's my problem with this. I mean, I tried to figure out what I could distill from this record that might be Mr. Hinderberger's claim. And one thing I thought was possible was an accusation of, you know, of pay to play, you know, that if you don't contribute to the mayor, then you don't get the contracts. We unfortunately have some experience of that in Chicago. So I thought maybe that, but that's not really spelled out at all. There are a tremendous number of things where Mr. Hinderberger didn't ever fulfill the conditions that the city imposed for funds, which the city itself points out. But cities have, I mean, there's a lot of red tape if you're going to deal with cities. And I don't know why Mr. Hinderberger is exempt from it. I understand your point about the, if there had been some focus on what exactly was the trade secret? How was it conveyed? How did the city use it? Then maybe, but I found so many gaps. I just couldn't quite sharpen it into a couple of points.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'd like to try to do that for you now. To be clear, Mr. Hinderberger is not suggesting that he'd be exempt from the red tape. Everyone knows there's red tape in local government, especially in the real estate business. The issue is that Mr. Hinderberger ought to be subject to the same red tape as everyone else. And he was not here. And the facts that support that are the Brown and Coyle project. That's a similarly situated developer in the same area that was not subject to the litany of different requirements that Mr. Hinderberger was. The Brown and Coyle project was also led by a campaign contributor. The issue here of Mr. Hinderberger not being able to satisfy the requirements, I agree, is troubling at first for Mr. Hinderberger's claims until you are able to back out and take the larger view and realize that at each instance, at each key point throughout Mr. Hinderberger's relationship with the city changed those requirements. First, at the very beginning, it was adding lots 6 through 9 to be an affordable housing component. And then once that was done, it was changing it and requiring LEED certification. And then once that was done, there was other requirements added throughout the years that served to slow down and mire Mr. Hinderberger's project, while other projects like the Brown and Coyle project were not subject to the same red tape and were in fact fast-tracked. And I see that my principal time here has expired, so
yes.
I'll go ahead and stop for now. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much. Mr. Wilfund.
Thank you. May it please the court and Chief Judge Wood. My name is Adam Wilfond, and I represent the Appalachian City of Indianapolis. This is a case about misunderstandings. Hinderberger did not understand what was required of him to obtain public funds from the city for his real estate project. And later in litigation, he did not understand what Local Rule 56.1 required of him in the face of a summary judgment motion. But misunderstandings don't lead to do-overs. And regardless of what Mr. Hinderberger may claim, that's what this appeal is really all about. Now, case law from this circuit provides substantial deference to district courts to enforce their own local rules. This is doubly true when it comes to local rules governing summary judgment. And as the sprawling record demonstrates, if there was ever a case for a court to exercise that discretion to strike a non-movement's factual statement for non-compliance, this was it. But even if this court decides that the district court abused its discretion in striking Hinderberger's factual statement, the evidence designated still fails to create a genuine factual dispute on any of the constitutional claims or state law claims he brought.
So, Mr. Wilfond, I should have asked Mr. Kozlowski this, but you may know the answer. How many chances did the district court give Mr. Hinderberger to come up with a compliant Rule 56 response?
The district court did not provide any additional chances after issuing its summary judgment order, which struck in entirety Mr. Hinterberger's facts and ruled on the summary judgment motion itself in one fell swoop.
Right. So that's what I thought. So is there any reason to find an abuse of discretion simply in the fact that the district court didn't give him one more chance to very substantially pare it down and also, of course, make the record references accurate, I'll say?
I haven't seen any case law from this circuit, Chief Judge Wood, that says that, you know, when a district court does not provide an additional opportunity to cure any sort of deficiencies, that somehow that constitutes an abuse of discretion. Mr. Hinterberger wasn't pro se. He was represented by all accounts by competent counsel. And so I don't think that that gets the abuse of discretion standard there. So with the abuse of discretion standard, there has to be the record has to contain no evidence on which a district court could rationally come to the conclusion that it did. Here, there's plenty in the record which allowed the district court to strike Mr. Hinterberger's factual statement for noncompliance. The district court spent a pretty generous amount of time trying to make sense of Mr. Hinterberger's citations, the evidence, parsing through the argument versus what the actual facts were, and pretty understandably threw up his hands and just said, well, I can't do it. And there's ample case law from this circuit that provided the district judge with the abuse of discretion to do that. And that's especially the case with the Southern District of Indiana, which is the second busiest federal judicial district in the United States, second only to the Southern District of New York. The district court found that that Mr. Hinterberger made no attempt to actually controvert what was in the city's statement of facts. It was filled with irrelevant information, legal argument, and insinuation, and that sort of thing. Now, Hinterberger's argument is that the district court abused its discretion in striking its fact statement because no reasonable person could agree that a court can penalize a party while also declining to sanction that party's lawyer. Well, this argument assumes, and Hinterberger makes clear in his reply, that a district court can either only sanction both the party and the lawyer or neither. Well, that's just not true. If anything, the opposite is true. District courts have wide latitude in determining when to impose sanctions and against whom. And Mr. Hinterberger's counsel points out, an attorney's acts or omissions are always going to be imputed to the client. That's just the law of agency that our legal system is built on. So to the extent—
Well, and I might add that within the attorney-client relationship, if the client is unhappy with something the attorney has done, there are ordinary remedies. There could even be legal malpractice, or there could be other remedies that maybe the court didn't want to get involved with.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Chief Judge Wood. If to the extent there's any remedy itself, as this court has mentioned on a few different occasions, it's not continuing the litigation against the original party. It's initiating a malpractice action against the wrongdoer for potential legal malpractice. So in sum, the district court didn't abuse its discretion here. There's ample case law for it to have done what it did. And as this court has said, if a party fails to comply with a local rule, that party has to suffer the consequences regardless of how harsh it might be. The other point I'd like to address is concerning Mr. Hinterberger's constitutional claims. On various occasions, this court has emphasized that it defers to the litigants themselves on how to best frame and pursue their legal claims. And the Supreme Court actually just reaffirmed this principle earlier last month. Now, in his reply, Mr. Hinterberger states that he has framed all his constitutional claims as Monell claims. He's suing the city under Section 1983. He's asking for damages. He's alleging that the injuries were caused by a custom or policy. And he hasn't sued an individual state actor. That's on page 8 of his reply. This is one of the most important wrinkles of his lawsuit. The reason is because even if he proves any constitutional claim, whether that's equal protection, due process, or whatever, in order to prevail on the Monell claims, there still has to be enough competent evidence that a city policy, practice, or custom actually caused those injuries, that a sufficient number of prior incidents existed to even call it a policy, practice, or custom, and that city officials were deliberately indifferent towards it. Now, the evidence, whether that's Hinterberger's 135 exhibits or just the city's factual statement, is insufficient to send this case to a jury to decide those constitutional claims. Now, I believe the city's brief adequately lays out my party's position. Unless the court has specific questions, I don't really have anything else to add. I will stand on my brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see no further questions. So you saved 2 minutes, Mr. Kozlowski, and you may have them.
Thank you, Chief Judge Wood. I'd just like to address 2 points quickly. The first is that this case is, is that this appeal is not seeking a do-over. It's really seeking a do. Mr. Hinterberger would like and requests that this court remand to the district court so that all of the facts that are laid out in the statement of the case on appeal, which were all drawn from the summary judgment materials, can be adjudicated and heard by the trier of fact. And that gets to the second point, which is, and this is addressed in the briefs at length, and so I won't go through it in detail here, but contrary to what Mr. Wilfond just said, Mr. Hinterberger did in fact present actual evidence on which a reasonable juror could rely in finding in Mr. Hinterberger's favor on each claim alleged, and therefore summary judgment was inappropriate and remand for trial is the appropriate remedy. And thank you very much. And I'd also like to say that of all these Zoom conferences that I have done, this has been the most streamlined and efficient. And I can say that I was hardly surprised by that.
Thank you very much. The court staff will appreciate your praise for them. We are in their debt for sure. So thanks to both counsel. We will take this case under advisement and we will move on to the next one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.